If some of you were at Tom Sine's talk on Saturday night, we heard a lot about how we're often content to look at the world how it is now, not think about the future. Our churches have in the past been content to stagnate. I've been a missionary for 5.5 years now with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And I want to tell you about an experience, about my experience with our church, which I don't think that has been the case in. Certainly we have in a way. But I think that our mission has taken a lot of risks to go into a country like Senegal, where we haven't been working for a long time. Lutherans in America, and certainly your church, whatever it is, I know there's some Presbyterians here and other churches, have been working in mission for a long time. In many countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, we've worked ever since the end of the 19th century and or early in the 20th century. And in almost all the countries where we work now, there are local churches. We no longer talk about mission fields. That's not the talk of today, but partner churches. There are local, independent churches, and it's with them that we work. You certainly heard some about the excitement in the African churches today, that those are the Christian churches that are growing quickly, and that sometime in the 21st century, by far the majority of Christians will be in the Southern Hemisphere. It's exciting in many places, but yet the African churches at the same time face enormous challenges. I was just reading an article in the ELCA World Mission magazine called World Encounter, and caught my eye because this girl you'll see in some of the slides, she comes from a village where I worked, the cover, and talking about the challenges in the future, the challenges of the African churches. One of the main ones is for leadership. There aren't enough trained pastors, and pastors that are trained, it's very difficult to pay them. People who are just barely making enough for themselves, plus probably supporting 10 cousins, uncles, nieces and nephews and whoever, do not tend to give to the church enough so that pastors can have working wages. There are problems with health care. Churches have always and still are working in health care very, very much in Africa, agriculture and whatever, and missionaries are still very badly needed. Requests come from these local churches for missionaries, and I think it would be easy for our churches to say, this is where our work is, this is our mission, simply to work in the historic areas of Lutheran involvement or whatever your church is, work where there are already Christians. My church, the American Lutheran Church, in 1973 decided that they wanted to branch out, go into a new country, go into new countries, as a matter of fact, and they wanted to work with Muslims, which, as you know, is a really risky thing to do. It's a risk. It's exciting because of that, because there are new possibilities. But working with Muslims is an area where traditionally Christians have failed. Ever since the Crusades, which remains in the memory of Muslims, where it was said that the work of the Christian towards Muslims was to go and kill them, to conquer those lands, through European history and certainly into American history. And talk about Muslims, and in the mind of most Americans, you think of Iran, the enormous problems we've had with them in the Middle East, and you know very well that the relationship between Christians and Muslims has been much more one of tension than of working together. Anything that could be called success, really, in any way, not just success as far as conversions or something like that, but even success in terms of good relationships. But that's what the ALC decided to do. Islam is becoming more and more important. It's growing faster than Christianity. The census is not real clear, but a rough, very, very approximate figure is that there are about 1 billion Muslims in the world. About the same number of Christians, but Islam is growing very quickly, especially in Africa. And they also chose a specific ethnic group called the Fulbe people. Now I'm just going to show the map here just a second and show where I have worked for the last 5.5 years. Okay, that's a good idea. As you know, this is the Sahara Desert. The area just south of the Sahara is known as the Sahel. It goes in roughly this area. And one of the main ethnic groups in that area are called the Fulbe people. And they're traditionally herders, growing some grain for themselves. It's a tough area, but they have learned to survive in a very difficult semi-desert area. Now, we have strong Lutheran churches in Nigeria, here in Cameroon, and in the northern parts of those countries, there's a number of Fulbe people, and that's how they started to reach out with them. So they decided in 1975 to send missionaries to Niger and Senegal, which is where I work, and work with that same ethnic group. There's one ethnic group all across that part of West Africa. There are about 10 million Fulbe in all living in the Sahelian area of Africa. Now, the question that I raised in the title of this session, and which we'll talk about, is how to reach out in working with an ethnic group that's not historically Christian like that. Now, I'm pleased to tell you that the old days of mission arrogance, I think, are for the most part gone. At least I haven't encountered that, like you read about in the novel Hawaii or something, where missionaries came in with the total truth into a godless society, brought God, brought everything about Western culture, which of course is godly. I think we're much more humble now. The executive director of our mission organization, Mark Thompson, often usually talks like this: we must be as the crucified Christ is in the midst of the pain and the suffering of our world. God's mission pulls us into solidarity, into presence with those in spiritual and physical pain. I think in the slide that I'm about to show, you'll certainly see that there are people in pain. Also, if you read the news, you know about the changing climate, the fact that the desert is, in a sense, going south. Although I talk about that tomorrow, it's not exactly moving south as we think about it, but areas are becoming desert that weren't once. And people, populations are growing, food production is remaining the same or even going down. So we're certainly, as Christians, called to be present in an area of suffering like that. So I want to show now some of the people with the needs, and through that share the way in which we in the ELCA, the Lutheran Church, have tried to be present among them. Certainly no great changes have been made, but we've tried to live with them and learn from them. I've learned a fantastic amount. I think anyone that's worked overseas will agree with that. You learn a lot more than you give. And then the questions you can think about during this and we'll discuss afterwards are, what is the mission of the church? What should it be? And should we work especially in areas where people are historically Christian? I think a lot of us today are very uncomfortable with thinking about conversion of people that are not Christian being touched by the gospel story and really changing their religion. It's not something we've often seen happen, of course, because we live in an area where people are historically Christian. So if they become Christian, it's like they come back into their roots. But in an area like Muslim Africa, they would be very much leaving their roots. And if the church has a mission to areas like this where people are not historically Christian, what is appropriate mission? And again, the titles I lifted up are development, which I can say is mostly what we've been doing. We've been working in some ways similarly to governments or any other organizations that work in development, that work to meet human needs, to help people to change their own lives, and to deal with the changing climatic conditions. Or should we be more deliberately involved in dialogue, sending pastors or Islamic scholars or wherever to talk with Islamic leaders? I think that's a viable approach. Or is it saving souls that is our goal? Most people are surprised when I don't do what their traditional view of evangelism is, what their traditional view of mission has been. in a way, I have a lot of questions. That's why I bring up the questions. Even after 5.5 years, believe me, we've struggled with these issues and struggled and struggled. We hope that what we do is a sort of evangelism. But obviously, nobody has come to believe in Jesus Christ through my work, not a person. And going into this area, that was never a goal. But rather, we of course hope and pray that somehow the Holy Spirit will work, that the church will become a reality in an area like this where it has never been before. But we're talking a very long time frame, perhaps 100 years is what I heard when I first went over there. I came back recently and heard people speaking about 500 years, so we don't know, but a long time, not something very, very soon. So think about those issues, and we'll do a lot of discussion. I don't have a lot of slides. It's not a huge slideshow. But can somebody turn off the lighting behind that thing?
Hey, that's my slide.
I know. Some of these are Barb's slides.
The fluorescent one is over there too.
The best slides are Bart's, it's true. I like to say I was just working. I didn't have time to take pictures, and that's true. People never like to get their picture taken. So I would let my visitors take a lot of pictures because, you know, by definition, they're intruding. I never took my own. So as Bart would say, welcome to Senegal. The area where I worked had variety. You'll certainly see big trees, a few, but by and large, this is what the landscape looks like. The beauty, as you can see, is not in the landscape, but in the people. I think you'll be struck over and over by how unbelievably beautiful both they are and the clothes that they wear. And the earrings you might want to note here, it's sort of a nice punk style of earring. But I think it's just absolutely stunning. This is their tradition. Traditionally, the people where I worked, as I said, the Fulbe people, grew their own grain. This is millet being harvested. The two main staples were millet and sorghum. But mainly they lived as cattle herders, because herding animals is the most appropriate ecological response to a zone like that. Rainfall is very erratic. You have to be able to move around to go where the rain is, and the way to do that is through cattle grazing. Traditional life isn't so easy. It's not as if things were really easy in the past. Water is the most difficult daily chore, and these people are fortunate because they have a well. Many have to go a long ways for it, but many people spend hours and hours each day pulling up water. This well, particular well, is about 180 feet deep, and you see that they're bringing up water for about 1,000 animals, plus of course all their cooking, washing, and everything else they need.
And those buckets are standing in line there, right?
No, they're all full.
Oh,
they're filling them
up.
They're filling them up, and you can't see a lot, but the sheep and goats in the background are in herds that belong to individual people. And when someone has enough wash basins full of water for his herd, then they'll be allowed to go and drink. It's very orderly. It's remarkable how well behaved those goats and sheep are. They stand in the sun and wait till their herder tells them they can go drink.
What's that? 180 feet, was that hand dug?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how long ago?
That's one of the older ones, and they're trying to deepen it because it doesn't have enough water in it anymore, but it's so narrow. It's only 1 meter in diameter. Now, they dig a lot still, that deep hand dug, but now they make them almost 2 meters in diameter simply so that you can get a pick up in the air and dig. That one is 1 meter in diameter. Nobody knows how they dug it, about 30 years ago, before independence. And the people paid for it themselves. They were very rich, they tell me, at that point, the people in this village. And they put their money together. Each one sold a cow, and they were able to pay for the cement and the well digger and everything involved in that. Gathering wood, an endless daily chore, always for women and young girls, as you see here. Obviously, one of the problems with deforestation, as trees are being cut down and trees are being lost to drought, is that people have to go further and further for firewood, which is the fuel of the poor. Women carrying things endlessly on their heads, and even these beautiful houses, or doesn't like to say huts, but they would, one person would have on one of these houses, are built by the women. Almost most of the daily tasks like that are women's work, as you know. So how do we respond in a situation like this? As I said before, one of the most important things we do is simply listen to people. I feel more and more that I'm no great agricultural expert. I mean, there's a lot of people here at Holden, I know right now, who know a lot more about gardening, especially organic gardening, than me. But what I love to do more than anything else is just sit around and talk with women, try and get more of a feel for their lives, get to know them better, and discuss together with them what they could do. In almost every village where I worked, the women were already organized before I started to work with them. There had been Lutheran missionaries before me who had worked with some of the groups, but even where they hadn't, women in that area tend to form themselves together. They have a president, vice president, treasurer, etc., and they often pay money into a common fund each month and then split that up or loan it to people who are in need, for example. That would be a typical function of the group. We try not to work only with the women, but also talk as much as possible with the men. This picture shows the chief in one of the villages, matter of fact, the one where you saw the well. I'm sorry about this guy holding a Polaroid picture. You see, again, I only take pictures when somebody else is there who had a Polaroid camera. But this old chief, this chief caused a lot of problems. He's very old. The dynamic young people, the village, didn't get along with him. So I just say that to remind you that, as in any culture, there are a lot of groups going on at the same time. There are the young women who have their agenda, and there are the old women. Often they can work together. There are the young men who are looking for change, who are looking to improve their villages, and then there are the old people, and especially the chiefs, who often want to hold on to the old way. It's not always that way, but trying to work together with all those groups is no easy task. So the task that I worked in, trying to help the women's group earn more money for themselves, obviously feed their children, improve nutrition too, but what they were interested in was having money. So because of this nice river that went through town, it was a branch of what's called the Senegal River, but this southern branch is not on the border. The northern branch goes over to the country of Mauritania. But anyway, there's plenty of water in it year-round, so gardening is a logical thing to start. So together with these women's groups, these women's groups that I told you about would begin to garden. They would get together and build fences out of the local materials that they had, sort of a bush that they would cut the wood off of just to get that wood. It was really a lot of work. Stand it up, tie it together with a little wire. And they started planting. Some of the gardens were great. Some of them were terrible. Although I realize I didn't have any pictures of the really terrible ones, but let me tell you, a lot of the gardens hardly produced anything. It all depended on the women that were there. I think this is Barb's slide too. The weather was almost always terrible there. You see the man wearing a turban that has a very clear function. It's because it's so windy and so dusty. It gives you a little idea of the variety of things that people planted. Lettuce, not your most practical crop, but they liked it because it's so easy. A lot of onions. I think that's corn in the front. A lot of cabbage and eggplant and things like that did all right. At the beginning, all the women that I worked with carried the water up from the river on their heads. Each bucket of water that went into the crops, and a lot of water is needed when the climate is that dry, was carried up by hand.
Where did this plastic buckets come from?
It's before my arrival, but it shows, as you point out, that people are by no means only dealing in traditional technology up to that point. Everybody uses plastic buckets because they work so well and they're light. They might have a few old wooden bowls or clay pots, but they're much heavier, so very widespread. In one of the women's groups that I worked with in particular, called Lair Abe, when we started the garden, we discussed the possibility of putting the garden right next to the rice field, which was already present in the city. That's a government program where huge 40-acre irrigated rice fields have been started, and the men form a cooperative. The women certainly work in those rice fields, but they sense very much that the ownership is the men's, simply because of traditional patterns. In this village, because hauling water is so exhausting, we discussed putting it next to the rice field and simply diverting a little bit of the water from the canals for the rice field. But the women would not hear of it. They said, unless we can have our own pump that we can control, the men will cause us no end of problems. They'll turn off the water if they're unhappy with us or whatever. We're going to carry the water up on our heads, and then it's our own. And then nobody can stop us from having the garden. Eventually, in this village, after they'd done a garden for 2 years, we helped them get this nice diesel pump. So they were really excited about that. It was the first time I had ever done anything like that, too. So there was asked a lot of advice, a lot of people. The women themselves put in 200,000 francs, which is about $600. And the ELCA, through the gift of a church in Illinois, about $1,800 for the whole setup. So it was a major purchase, and the pump is still running. It's had its problems along the way, but it is still running. They have a young man that takes care of it, and the women pay for the upkeep through the proceeds from their garden. Of course, when the pump came back, there was a lot of dancing. This is an old slide. But anyway, the women there were really happy that now they had their own pump that they could control and didn't have to depend on the men. And of course, this is one of the most wonderful things about it. Being in Africa, I wasn't from one of the most musical areas, but they could beat a drum really well, which is, of course, those plastic basins. They work really well for that, or metal basins. You turn them over and beat on them and get that nice beat going, and then the women dance. Some of the gardens now are looking really spectacular. This last 2 years, I had a really good time working with solar pumps. These are so expensive still, as some of you may know, that it's sort of beyond the means of the Lutheran Church at this point, as it's still a technology that's being developed, and there hasn't been enough use to really bring the price down. This setup of solar panels cost about $20,000. So that would be a little beyond our means. But the Belgian government wanted to put some in, so they came to me as someone who had lived there for a long time and asked if I knew any good women's groups, which I did, some great groups. And so two of the groups that I worked with had these pumps installed, and now they're really working well. It's an electric pump. And so this is a garden, as a matter of fact, that's irrigated from a solar pump. So the women are very excited about it. They don't have to worry about changing the oil and putting gasoline in. However, they do have to amortize the pump, which is the most difficult thing I've ever had to try to work with people to understand or to accept. Anyway, I think in traditional culture, the idea is if you have something, you have it and you share it. But to put away something aside each year in order to buy a new one when it's worn out is not something that was very easy. But they are supposed to put aside $600 a year almost $1,000 a year, so that at the end of 5 years they'll have $5,000 to buy a new pump. We'll see. They're 2 years into it now, and I would very much like to go back then and see how it'll work out. So with this production, obviously people are eating a lot of it themselves. Women are also able to bring it to the market and sell it. And the money they make from that, they get to keep. Women traditionally have their own money there. So that's good. They often buy clothes for their children. They often buy food for their family if their husband doesn't provide it. Traditionally, the husband is supposed to provide it, but of course, doesn't always. And many of them are, them have husbands that are away working in the capital city of Senegal or even in France or points further away. So they really are the heads of the family, so they desperately need the money. Ecologically, of course, one of the most important things we can do is to plant trees. You saw what the soil looked like. Obviously, it's not great topsoil that's being lost. But still, trees enable people to have more wood to cut down for firewood. They produce food themselves. This tree, which if any of you are from Arizona, might recognize it as the mesquite, is good for fodder for animals, produces seeds that people can eat, and especially it cuts down the wind in the gardens. So we're trying to encourage all the gardens to plant trees. So the way we did it is that the same women's garden groups planted their own seedling nurseries. And so they filled up all these little bags with a mixture of sand and manure, and then they pounded the seed pods to get them out. I need to show both these photos to see which is better. And planted and watered over the course of about 3 months. Then they had seedlings that were transplantable. Sometimes the man helped. Okay, I have a purse.
What do you got that purse?
Yeah.
Your phone line? Yeah.
God, that's that way. Well, here's the men carrying the trees, at least. The men often plant the trees. They don't often take care of them like the women do, but they would often, in a big campaign, you see all the grass now. It's good to see there is a rainy season. It does rain during July and August, basically, 2 months of rain during the year, and grass grows miraculously. And you plant trees at that time, and they have a tough time surviving the first year, but if they can get through that, you plant trees that traditionally can survive on just a few months of rain. Here's a tree in the dry season. We even put these old pans around them to conserve the little bit of water that they had. And this one I just put in because I like, one time, the women of this village called Gomaji had grown a whole bunch of seedlings, and so they were passing them out to different people to plant as a shade tree in their yard. This guy was sort of passing through on his camel, and he said, "Give me some trees. I want to take them to my village." And we said, "Well, how are you going to transport them to your village? I mean, this is a tree." And he said, "I'm going to take them on my camel." So he did, and I was really amazed that one time, over a year later, I was lost, which happens on the roads, which are really tracks in the sand, and I came upon this village where I'd never been, and they rushed right out and they said, "Jane Basso," which is what they called me, "you've come to look at your trees." And there they were, Moses Green, he planted them.
And there they are.
That was a better caption to this picture. What I was going to say is not everybody plants trees. Obviously, with fuel as short as it is, there is a lot of pressure on the land to cut them down, too. These trees can be made into charcoal. Charcoal is sold in the capital city of Dakar, and that's cash income for people. And when you're in an area so short of cash, people are willing to even destroy their heritage, the trees that have lived for hundreds of years for that. So that's a tough issue for me. It's hard to know what a church can do in that case. It's sort of more of a problem that governments need to solve and simply people need to solve at their village level to forbid villagers from cutting down the village's trees, which many of the villages have done. As we seek to listen to people and meet them in the needs that they have. I'm very happy to say that sort of my replacement anyway, the person that is still in the village where I was in June is Terry Gibson, who is an animal specialist, especially because he's in goats. So we don't have a lot of goat specialists from America, but that is one of the number one animals there. It's the animal that people live on. They love cows, but cows are too big to sell and to slaughter when you need $30 or something to buy food. You sell a goat. So goat is really a major production. So he's there with his family and learning the language still, and then starting to work with probably healthcare for animals, first of all. Another area that we work in is healthcare. This is a woman named Sushi Engelbrecht, who's in Seattle right now, but she works training village people to do their own healthcare. The age of the missionary hospital is also passing. It was really a need at the time when missions went in. There were no hospitals. The government was totally incapable and uninterested in healthcare for the poor in rural areas. So all across Africa, the missions started the hospitals. But now the government can do that, even if they do it poorly. And so the missions are trying to work in primary health care, enabling people to take care of their own health needs as much as possible. So there are two health workers chosen by a village, and she's going to be working with them for several years as they develop a health care structure within the village. And they build things called health huts. And I let you judge how attractive that looks like as a place to go and get healthcare trees. You see the trees around the corners. So maybe in a few years it will be a shady paradise. The way she gets out to these villages, even though she has a car, is in horse carts. Because the village owns the horse cart and the horse, and has to go and pick up her and the government nurse who works as supervisors. Always trying to make sure that the changes that we work to promote will last long after we're gone, and hopefully, since things are in the control of village people, they will have enough interest in keeping it up themselves so that people can have healthy children like this one. Another really crucial area of working is in water. As I said before, water takes up an enormous amount of time for most people. The lucky ones are those who have a well, even if it's 180 feet deep in their own village. Many have to go 5 miles or more to get water. So one of the things we tried this last year, and also now as I leave, we were just getting started on another well, is helping villages dig wells. So this is in a village called Benyalol, where the people had a well, but it was very far from their garden, and so this was relatively near the water, the river, so this well would not be deep. It was only about 50 feet deep in the end, and it's done. But anyway, to start it out, we just picked a spot and marked it out, and he started digging. A few days later, he's down below his head. Now he has to start passing the sand up in buckets up to his helpers who are above. And much later, it becomes a standard well, as there are so many of in that area. So it's something we've looked into a lot, and we needed to figure out more how we can work in providing water for people in this very water-short area. And finally, this last year, as many of you know, 50,000 refugees, very unexpectedly, came to the area of Senegal where I worked. I'm going to talk about them on Saturday, so I'm not really going to go into that here. It was something that just fell into my lap, sort of absolutely unexpected, but suddenly there were all these refugees. So, you know, fortunately people were there, and they were cared for as well as we could for people who didn't know anything about working with refugees. But I won't talk about more about that here. A lot of questions. I just thought I'd bring up a few, because people here realize that things aren't as great as sometimes they sound. There I was, living in a fairly simple house, but I had this great car, which I know, especially since I got back, is now really the yuppie car. So there I was, working with very poor people, driving around in a yuppie car. I think a lot of questions could be asked. I mean, is this the best, the way that that we as the church can best reach out to people in need. Also, I just thought I'd show that we don't live so as simply as maybe often people think. I don't know if it's surprising. Usually when people go to Africa, they're surprised that things aren't as difficult physically as they expect, but find out that the difficulties working overseas are in the slowness of change. People, it's hard to figure out what your work can be. It's hard to figure out how to encourage people to change. But anyway, what we try to do is just be present among people and listen to them. One person whose life has been touched is this woman, Haokoile Ba, who is an extremely intelligent woman. She lives in a village called Woramaham. And every time, she's not the president of the women's group, but anytime anything would be suggested, she would go out and try it. And of course, women are not encouraged to do that in traditional African societies. And that's why I worked with her and talked with her more than any other woman in that village. So I often wonder, I mean, if I ever go back, I will certainly go and visit her. I wonder how her life has changed. Obviously, you never have a whole lot of possibilities, but I hope that maybe through our friendship, through discussing so much with people, maybe they've learned something from me. I've certainly learned a lot from them. And we hope that maybe children who are growing up today, maybe their lives will be different in the future. At least they will have lived with Christian people, which they wouldn't have otherwise. The area where I was of people who come from there were 100% Muslim. There are Christian Senegalese living there. And so together we formed a community, a Christian community in a very strongly Muslim area. As I look back, I can't tell you what changes came about. I mean, sometimes people say to me, oh, you must see that there was a lot more food production when you left than when you started. Well, I really couldn't. But maybe in the next generation, people will grow up with different attitudes.
That's what needs to be hoped.
Anyone can open the curtains if you want to, those who are sitting back, or if it doesn't bother you to have the lights, the light kind of dim. So that gives you a little bit of an overview of how we are working in Senegal. I'd be very happy to hear any comments you have, questions, okay, or comments on what you think of, you know, how would you reach out in areas like this and I'm sorry.
How did you see the Muslim spirituality affecting how they, for example, saw their interaction with the environment or with their lifestyle? And you know, with learning what
wow.
Christians we think of idea of stewardship with the environment is, how do you think their particular spirituality affected?
That is a really good question. I don't know if anybody else has worked in areas similar or if you have any thoughts on that off the top of my head. Well, I have to go away and think of that question, frankly. Asking about Muslim spirituality, I'm really glad of that, especially after Dan's Bible study this morning when he talked about, you know, Jesus as a spirit person. I think anyone who's lived in Africa knows that there, like he often brought up the Native American culture, but African culture too, know about spirits. And so they're Muslim, but Muslim in an African way. I mean, some people think that it's a weakness of the African church or African Islam that it's so unorthodox. And in a way, it's often accused of being heretical. A lot of African bishops do not get along with the Pope at all. And it's usually because of things like healing. But I like to think of it more as a strength of African culture. They can take anything in, Christianity, Muslim, whatever, and make it African. So African Islam, like the African church, is very African. And the Islam that I saw is especially respects the power of the holy men. And that's what people are oriented towards. Giving them money, giving them gifts, especially, and respecting them, and in some way getting power from heaven through those people. But the environment, I'll really have to think about that.
Can I just say, it seems like, I just remember that you were saying that if you can help people see that it's really important to take care of the trees that God planted, for example, that Islam means submission, and that can almost turn into fatalism sometimes, that you don't take sort of steps to do a lot of stuff, but there's certainly a much stronger understanding of God's presence in every aspect of life. And they're always saying, thanks be to Allah for this, that, the other thing. I mean, Allah be praised is the greeting. All. So that the idea that that Allah planted this tree that just sort of grew to life here. I mean, we might think the seed just fell there and grew there, but it seemed like people were always saying, God put this tree here, that God did this, God did that, and that kind of thing is everywhere. They didn't care about the trees that Jane planted so much, but they liked the trees Allah planted.
Well, they didn't believe that they would ever grow. I mean, yeah. Okay. A lot of people said that no tree has ever grown in this village except the ones that God planted. So it was, well, in the 19th century, a lot of it, early 20th, too, is because it was anti-colonial. The countries under colonial power were not interested so much in following the colonial religion. Also, it has the appeal of being very out in the open. I mean, we're taught to pray in a closet or whatever it is. I mean, you never pray and announce your fasts and stuff. Muslim people are constantly right in the middle of the market, right in the middle of the street, wherever you are, in the middle of your yard, wherever you are, if it's time to pray, people will put out a mat and pray. And it does impress you. And I think people, with reason, sometimes wonder, I mean, are Christians doing something? We don't see any difference in their lives. But with Muslims, you can easily see. Also, it explains things. At least the Islam that I saw tends to have an answer for most things. And I think that's, well, Christianity often can be that way, too, at a certain level. People are looking for meaning, and they're certainly looking for power. And once you have a certain amount of people following a Muslim teacher in an area like mine, then more people will start following that person because it will be seen that he has power. There should be a lot more reasons.
In the Quran itself, I think as a Christian, when I read it, it seems so legalistic and so structured.
Yeah, that's what I mean by the answer. Yeah.
I wondered when you spoke with these women, I mean, were they curious about your purpose in a sense? Or did they just accept you almost like you would, like a government aid person? How did they see your role? Were they curious?
I didn't find that people too often asked, and that's sad. I mean, I'm embarrassed that I didn't somehow cause more questions to people to say, you know, who is this God that you follow that, you know, you work like this? But they didn't. No, they just said that more like a government aid person. I think that was the problem. So I learned from them a lot about learning, using the language of God, what God has given me regularly, what God is doing in this garden, and accepting that more and more is done by God's power. But I'm disappointed to say there wasn't more curiosity. Once in a while there would be, and that's why I think our presence was important, because there would be nobody else to ask, but not so much. People were happy to just work together. Did you have a question?
Well, you probably answered it. Actually, it was along the same lines as the question God asked. I had the luck to be in a Muslim place for a while, a short time, and when we were introduced to the Muslim faith, there was a woman there who said the heart of the Muslim faith is an ethical commitment to people and nature. And I wanted to say, where do you sign up, you know? But that was Asian, that was Indonesia, where the culture was underlaid with other long-term influences. And what I wondered was, do you see the Muslim faith doing the kinds of things you were doing? Does it eventuate in a project with moral implications like development, like helping people with gardens? Is there some kind of outflow of that sort that you see coming from the Muslim community?
not in an organized way, but much more, because that was the faith of the people. I mean, Muslims were doing a lot. There was this incredible solidarity between family members, for example, who would send incredible gifts of money one to another, or who would help anyone who was in need through the village structure. So it became Islamic because it was done by Muslims, and Islam permeates all parts of their life. I never saw any organizations similar to the Christian aid organizations. And that I think is striking.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. We, especially when the refugees came, you try and not criticize anybody, but it was very hard for us to see why, when one group of Islamic people, Mauritanians, who were Muslims, were expelling all these other people who were Muslims. So you suddenly hit, you had this conflict between hundreds of thousands of all, you know, of Muslim people, and many Muslims left destitute. Why the Muslim organizations weren't doing more. Don't know. Saudi Arabia did send a delegation, but no sort of programs on the scale of what the Christians are doing. But maybe it's simply because we have more money
than Saudi Arabia.
Well, I don't know.
James, wasn't it controversial for you to even be there as a Christian and also to be working primarily with women? I would think that those two things would be really counterculture.
We did have a problem about 3 years ago, and now it seems so far back I hardly think about it. But at one point we decided to start a center in addition to these sort of development projects, and the center was going to have a library, and there would be Christian books and non-Christian books, but so people could go there and read, you know, current events, history, science, whatever, and also about Christianity if they wanted, and also about Islam. We wanted to, although we never had a lot of success getting a lot of Muslim books in there. But for various reasons, and then we used that building as a worship place, which is probably a mistake. I mean, one of the millions of mistakes I made, but I really think that was. So the local leaders, when they found out about it, a year or two after we had been doing about it, but all of a sudden it became very important to them that they said it's a church, and we don't want a church in this village. We were within our legal rights, for sure. Senegal has a secular government, and you're allowed to worship anywhere that you want in the country. But the local people said, we don't want that, and so we said, that's fine. It was very interesting because it became a big political issue beyond anyone's imagining. I mean, I can't tell you how unimportant we were in this village, I mean, in this area. But it sort of became the thing that the leaders all jumped on. So finally we had a big meeting with the government officials, and then they decided, and we said, you know, we're really sorry, we're happy not to worship there anymore, we'll just worship in our homes. And they said, no, we don't even want you to worship in your homes. And then finally the government official had to say at that point, well, you know, you don't have any right to say that, sorry, but people can pray wherever they want. And besides, you know, how would you know? No, are you saying that nobody can pray? Because what we would say is, you are people that pray, we are also people that pray, and you respect that. Certainly Islam, it respects the right of others to pray. And then they said, well, one person can pray, but as soon as you have two or more people together, then it's a church, and we don't want that. So we thought that was very biblical. And so we don't want that. So it was a big controversy. Finally, the government... our local government head had to say, hey, that's out of your realm, you can't say that. After that, the issue pretty much died down, kind of flared up at various times, but that was our only main controversy, and I think the majority of regular people in town were certainly against those leaders' actions. And the more I analyzed it, I wondered if it wasn't more like your other question, that leaders are always threatened. I mean, especially a certain kind of leader, not real leaders, but leaders who rely on ignorance of people. So to follow them unquestionably, they're always threatened if you're working to empower those. Maybe that's too grandiose a view of what we're doing, but I think in a very small way, encouraging literacy, encouraging learning, or whatever, is a threat to locally established power.
Yeah. you say you're working to empower. Do you hope that in 5 or 10 years that they can do without you, that they will have people who can do these things?
Well, maybe, you know, in a sense they do now. I mean, there's really a lot of questions about our mission in Senegal. I'm leaving the gardening program. Each garden has their structure. They've got their bureau, as they call it, all their officers. They've got people who know how to garden. They've got some kind of a water system. And whether they manage to repair it, and, I mean, pay people to repair it, it's the money that's the problem. It's not usually the technical knowledge. It's forking over the money when you need to buy a new part, and parts are not cheap. You know, all the things that we're used to because, you know, some of us have grown up with our parents tearing their hair out when the car needs to be fixed. But it's in our mindset that you pay to keep things in order. So whether all these things will work together and the gardens will keep going, I don't know. But I felt like it was the right time for me to leave and us not to work in gardens anymore. Anyway, I think with animals, it's a new thing. Very few organizations are successfully working with animals for some reason. Herders are not necessarily easy people to work with. I think African men are not easy to work with, so I never wanted to work with them. But in a sense, everything could go on. I mean, their society goes on just fine without us. So it's not that, you know, we can leave and something will go on. But it's the Christian presence that we still felt. I mean, there are simply no Christians from that ethnic group still. And when will there be? We don't know. But if we think it's important to have a Christian presence, then we need to continue to be there.
When you went there, did you know what you would be doing, or did that happen after you were there?
Well, somebody before me had worked in gardens, and it seemed like one of the easiest ways to produce an income. I mean, that's my interest. Women can't be empowered unless they have some money. It's a sad way of looking at it, but more and more that's how it seems to be. So I wanted to do some kind of projects where they would be able to have an income and make their own decisions from that income. And that's why I worked in gardens. My background is much more in water and soil. So I'm embarrassed to say, because very smart people here keep asking me technical questions about organic gardening, and I only know what I kind of read while I was there, because all these creatures would attack the gardens. The worms, grasshoppers, mice. Termites, mice. Oh, that was a big one. What do you do about mice organically or with chemicals? Oh boy. Toads. At one point, there were so many toads that they would sort of crush the plants, although they don't really eat them or anything, but there would just be so many. You get like 100 on one garden bed, and your little plants have a hard time standing up to them. So I'm no great gardener, I'm sorry to say. And that would be something that somebody could work in the future. But I had an idea that I would work with gardening, yeah. The trees I kind of got into myself, the wells, and some other things. Our mission organization left an unbelievable amount of freedom up to the individual missionaries to see what the needs were locally and try and develop some programs, which is the harder part. It's easier to see the needs than to see what can be done. Obviously, if it were easy, it would already have been done.
What did those little fences keep out of the gardens?
Goats, especially. That's by far the most important predator. Because all the people are herders. Cows, donkeys too. Donkeys caused a lot of problems, but obviously not mice. Rabbits were another problem. We thought of building fences small to keep the rabbits out, but that would be tough.
They looked pretty arid. Did they take the herds distances from the village to mm-hmm. graze? Were the men who were doing this very typically gone for days at a time, or weeks at a time?
Well, me, who knows nothing about animals, I can tell you this. Cows are very smart, and cows smell water. So I'm told, like 10 miles away, they know where the water is. And they go off, and they get their drinks, and then they walk home. Nobody ever herds the cows there. Sheep and goats, they have to, yeah. And little boys from the age of 5 to 10, maybe 15 at the outset, do the herding of them. That is horrible work. As I looked at it, I had new realization of what a humble group of people shepherds are, at least in our area. It was very lowly. You're out all by yourself for a whole day, nothing to do except watch your sheep and goats, and then you bring them in the evening. But they, at the limit of the dry season, you could be 15 kilometers, so about 10 miles away from water, and the cows would walk in to the water and walk back out the long ways. But that's how nomads survive. That's something that we're waking up to again today, especially during colonial times. It was decided that nomadic ways are too old-fashioned somehow. We'll improve production through setting up ranches where a certain amount of land will be, you know, fenced, and people will 1 year have the cattle here and another year here and another year here and stuff. And realizing that in an area like that where there not only is there too little rain, but especially it comes in patches. And it's amazing how often it'll be raining here, and over at the village center it won't be raining. And especially as by the time you get down, you know, a mile in another direction, it could easily not be raining. It's very patchy. So you have to be mobile to go where the rain is, which is where the grass is. It's a really good system. We're learning more and more. Okay, one more question.
The kids do the herding and the women do the building.
What was your answer, Dick? They asked a theological question?
No, I said a theological question.
Oh, I thought, well, they, and of course they are the religious leaders. I mean, some of them do that. What I like to say, my analysis of it is they manage. They're like the managers. They make all the decisions, and then they have the women and the children to do the work. Does that make sense? I mean, it sounds, but we have managers too that don't clearly do any physical work. And, you know, there's nothing worse than gathering wood or water. It's a mindless task. You don't need any thoughts. There's no decision to make. There's no way to make it easier. You just have to, especially water, you just have to go again and again to where your water source is, fill up the bucket or the basin, put it on your head, and walk huge distances. It's so mindless. And those are the kind of tasks that are always women's work, it seems. But decisions do have to be made, and you know where maybe the whole herd and family and village is going to move from this place to where there's rain. A man have to find out where it's raining. I mean, through really good contacts from another person, you know, maybe it's rained over 20 miles over here. Well, we're going to move that way, or at least we're going to move the herds, and those kind of decisions. Also, a lot of them have emigrated with cash so short now. It's really become almost tradition where I am to leave to find work somewhere and send money back. They are good at that. But the division of labor in Africa is far, far from equitable. I mean, it's said that, is it worldwide? Oh boy, check my statistics, where that women do two-thirds of the world's work, which of course means twice as much as men. And in parts of Africa, certainly it's much more than that. And we'll talk more about that, I think, on Friday. So thank you very much. Yeah.